720 WGN. Hi there, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today. Grateful to you for sharing part of your Saturday with me, as ever. Lots to do on the show today. We're going to be talking about a really interesting lawsuit, kind of in the, well, now I've seen it all sort of category, but it is right here in our backyard, so we're going to be talking about that. And we're going to be talking about an entrepreneur, kind of a timeline for an entrepreneur you've definitely heard of, doing lots of stuff that just, lots of stuff did not go well. So we're going to be talking about that. And Foursquare, you remember that service, that app, that social media platform, how it kind of went away? Well, you're probably using it and you don't even realize it. So we're going to be talking about that. But before we get to that, please welcome Josh Dean to the program, who is a writer and author and who recently wrote in Bloomberg about Julia Landauer, one of the best new female stock car racers, and her attempt to break into NASCAR professionally, and how she's really being stifled by a lot of difficulty around sponsorships and sort of, it was sort of this look that he wrote in Bloomberg. And it's a very, very interesting one, because it's really not just about skill in NASCAR. It's a lot about business too, of who makes it and who does not. So please welcome to the program, Josh Dean. Thanks so much for being with us, Josh.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I appreciate you taking time out of your Saturday. So talk us through this particular racer that you profile, because it is a really, sounds like she's doing a lot. I mean, you feel kind of worn out just by the end of the story, because it sounds like she's really kind of up against a bit of a timeline. There's a time crunch on it, and it sounds, you know, frustrating, yet she's keeping her optimism.
Yeah, I mean, the story is really tangentially about her being a woman. That's one interesting thing about her, but it really applies, I think, to so many young race car drivers. And race car driving is unique among the professional sports, I think, in that it's really hard to just come up from not having means. It's almost impossible. You know, it's not just about you and a ball, and maybe you get some coaching. Cars are expensive, and having teams to back you is extremely expensive. So racers tend to either come from a lot of money or they really struggle. Julia is somewhere in between. You know, her parents have been able to support her to some extent, but not like they're paying $500,000 a year to just send her racing. So what a racer has to do is find money to pay for that. They have to go out and chase sponsors. So the job is like not just racing. It's not just about being a good driver. It's about how well can you sell yourself to companies who might want to help pay for your racing. And you can imagine why companies, they're gambling, right? They may not be willing to write these big checks because they're like, well, what if you don't make it? I'm basically giving you money to try and reach something, and what am I going to get out of it?
Right. And is this something that does it seem to be the case anyway, as you were looking at this story, does it seem to be the case that perhaps female drivers are up against this more? And is it, you know, I know we've talked a lot on this program about venture capital for women, and we've talked with female entrepreneurs that perhaps are asked a lot of different questions than male entrepreneurs are by venture capitalists prior to investing. Do you think that's a case of that, or is that just or is it perhaps something else?
I mean, I think it's probably naive to suggest it has no effect. And I think, you know, Julia is pretty careful about that, and she definitely is not out there screaming sexism and lack of opportunity. But I do think it's undeniable that a female in a male-dominated industry in racing is, you know, I mean, dominated barely describes it, right? It's almost all men.
Yeah.
Not just the drivers, but the mechanics, the coaches, the marketer. You know, it's really a male. So certainly I think she probably has to prove herself to an extent that men might not, but she also tries to flip it around and say, like, I present an opportunity that should be unique. And I think what frustrates her more than anything, what frustrates her more than the fact that maybe it's harder for her to convince people she's legitimate, is that where are all these brands that want to market to women? 40% of NASCAR fans are women. Women make a huge percentage of the purchasing decisions in vehicles around America. So she's sort of like, why are these companies that want to reach women not looking to me and looking to other women? It shouldn't just be beer and auto parts, right? Like, you know, she had a funny quote to me about, like, she would love to drive a pink car with a tampon on the side.
Right.
But, you know, Playtex isn't calling yet.
Right. Right. There was a very funny quote in the story about that. And she mentioned how much she liked the idea of a bunch of male race car drivers chasing that car with, you know, feminine hygiene products all over it, which I'm up for that. I think that would be quite funny. But, you know, you also point out a really another interesting thing we don't think of, well, I think a lot with NASCAR, and that is and racing in general. And that is the barrier of entry being as high as it is. I don't think, you know, I know I probably had not put a lot of thought into what it takes for an ambitious young driver financially to get into that game, as opposed to having access to like a basketball and a basketball hoop, being able to practice, that it really goes beyond just whether or not you have the skills to do it. But in fact, you know, do you have the financial means to do so? And it sounds like she has some degree of the financial means to kind of float herself into this. But at the end of the day, those sponsors do need to come.
Right. I mean, she's in the sort of the fourth tier, the K&N series, which is just below the Camping World Truck Series, which is just below the Xfinity Series, which is just below the Cup, the Monster Cup that's NASCAR as we think of it. And at her level, it's $300,000 to $500,000 a year to race. And if you can't come up with sponsors who are going to pay for that, you have to pay for it somehow. And her parents are paying some of it, and she's got some sponsors. And she feels like she's at a point where she needs to move up to trucks next year, and that's $3 to $5 million, and it climbs from there. So, yeah, I don't have the data to back this up. I'm not sure anyone has ever done this kind of a study, but I would bet that more talented drivers wash out in racing than talented players in any other sport. Because if you're a great pitcher, you're a great basketball player, you're a great tennis player, you're going to get noticed. You know, it might be harder for you because you might not have access to the best coaches, but probably somebody is going to find you. And that, I think, is not necessarily true. I bet there are some amazing racers out there who just, like, race on their local tracks on Saturday in their own beater car because they know that, how am I ever going to get access to $300,000?
Right.
And up from there, right?
Yeah. Well, it's a really interesting look. So everybody head to Bloomberg.com and check out this story. I'll be sure and tweet a link out to it as well so people can find it if you're following me on Twitter. So thank you so much, Josh Dean, for being with us today.
Of course. Happy to do it.
Thanks so much. All right. We're going to take a little break. And when we return, we are going to be talking a little bit about Foursquare. Do you remember Foursquare, the location-based app that you would use and check in places and you could become mayor of places? Why, I was even mayor of WGN Radio for a little while. Well, you're probably still using it and you don't even realize it. So we're going to be talking about that next when we come back on 720 WGN. Hey there, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us and thanks for sharing part of your Saturday with me. Always grateful to you for that. I'll be back here 7 o'clock for the Saturday night special till 9 p.m. Big show for you, ready to go for that. But still lots to do here today on the program. Joining us now is Jeff Wise, who is a science, tech, and adventure writer, and wrote a piece in Bloomberg about Foursquare. Remember Foursquare? It was like the app with locations, and you could check in a place and tell people where you were so you could potentially meet up with your friends or make new friends or whatever, and you could become mayor of a place, meaning you had authority on being in that spot. Well, it kind of went by the wayside, right? People caught on for a while, but then it went away in favor of new apps. But here's the thing. You are probably using Foursquare and you do not even realizing it. So, Jeff, tell us what in the world, where are we using Foursquare without even realizing it?
Well, it's kind of an interesting story how the company evolved. Because as you say, it was a really hot ticket a while back. It debuted at South by Southwest and kind of became a media darling, and sort of it was real popular among sort of urban millennials. You know, single people going out, and you know, as you said, you could kind of check into a bar, and if you checked in the most times, you become the mayor of that place. And so there was kind of a gamification element to it. And this was a time when social media was starting to turn people's heads, and everyone was thought, okay, social media is going to rule the world. But then it kind of never really caught on. It never sort of reached that critical mass that like something like Facebook or Instagram did. And so it never got a really huge user base. It had like 50 million users, which is good, but it's, you know, not enough to really get you that sort of unicorn valuation that everybody wants. And plus, social media itself kind of cooled down. I mean, you know, so Facebook is still going strong, of course, but like this idea that like social media is going to be the next thing that's going to make a wave of billionaires kind of went away. And you know, the, I think the money in the tech world is always looking for that next huge thing. Everybody wants to get the unicorn. And so it was no longer the flavor of the month. It sort of lost its novelty value. And it was kind of limping along. And it just wasn't looking good. But then the people in charge over there realized that, hey, you know, we're actually sitting on this asset that we're not using, which is, as people use our app, we're gaining all kinds of information about the world that they're moving through. So, for instance, if you check into a bar, your phone, which is a computer that's rigged with all kinds of sensors, and you can sense, like, the Wi-Fi networks around you. You can sense the cell phone networks around you. And you can, you know, using that information, Foursquare realized that they could really accurately determine where people were. They had been using that technology so that they could say, oh, hey, you're in TGIF's right now. And so do you want to check into TGIF's? Well, they realized that they could notify. Now, say you are TGIF's and you want to know if there's people in your store, and you can sell them stuff or you can make them special offers, or maybe they're walking outside, you want them to come in. And so they had developed this technology that wasn't really – it was kind of useful to the consumers, but it was really useful to businesses. So they kind of made a big pivot. They're still producing these the consumer-facing app, which is called Swarm, and which is, you know, a way that you can kind of keep track of where you've been going. They have another one called Foursquare City Guide, which, you know, is a way that you can – find out about, like, where's a great place to get barbecue and stuff like that. So they're still producing that stuff for the consumers. But what they really want is the consumers to be gathering data about the world that their cell phone sees it, which they can then sell that data to and the technology to end users. Like, so, for example, Uber, for instance, can use their what they call location intelligence, so that if you want to go to, say, the Grand Hyatt Hotel, you don't have to know the address. You can just say Grand Hyatt, and it'll and then Uber will know where to take you.
And so what are some other maybe more, I don't want to say more practical, because that's perfectly practical, but maybe some other more loftier, perhaps, applications of gathering that data for maybe retailers or for organizations or things like that?
Well, they've kind of made a splash by putting out these press releases where they have said, like, I believe it was Chipotle, where there was kind of a scandal involving Chipotle. And they could say, they can see from their data what percentage of their users are within X number of feet of a Chipotle store at any given time. And so they're actually able to track in a relative way whether foot traffic is going up or down. So they can say, oh, in the wake of such and such a thing, such and such an event, traffic has gone down or traffic has gone up. And this is very useful for advertisers, not just if, like, some kind of crisis erupts, but also to see if their advertising works.
Right.
And so, you know, if someone does a big ad push and now I'm seeing from Foursquare that my foot traffic is going up. And just in general, you know, Foursquare makes a very compelling case that, you know, people, you know, online sales is obviously a big and booming part of the economy, but the vast majority of transactions still get conducted in the real world. You know, you go to get your oil changed, you go to buy a lawn chair, you go out into the world and you buy stuff in physical space. And so if Foursquare can have a leg up in telling businesses where people physically are in the world, that can be very valuable. You know, of course, this is all taking place in a context where, as excitement about social media has faded, excitement about big data has really blossomed. And so these companies, as we know, like, you know, talking about Facebook again, every time you do anything online, you click, you like your friend's post about their new boots. Now, that's information about you. Now the online world of data gatherers knows that you're someone who's potentially, who knows, a boot buyer.
Right.
And so that goes into the big soup of information that's out there in the cloud about you.
Yeah.
And so.
It's interesting. I would say it's just interesting how much we are teaching advertisers about us in a given day without even really realizing it. Just as you said, on likes and reposts and retweets and all of those things.
Yeah, and this is a real aspect of modern life that we're still kind of grappling with as it's developing. And you know, there's good aspects and there's potentially scary aspects. You know, it's good that if you are looking for boots and the cloud knows that you are looking for boots and it can help you, you know, provide you with that information. But it's also a little scary. You know, you could be potentially manipulated or, you know, just given a false, not even false information, but a sort of skewed set of data, which, you know, we saw in the most recent election where there was a lot of people being fed, you know, this kind of filter
like
bubble.
Curated, yeah, yeah.
Curated, exactly.
It does bring up a lot of really, really interesting issues around questions around privacy and data and all of that. And as we're making our lives so much easier with technology, there are, of course, a lot of considerations, and sometimes they don't come up until they come up. You know, sometimes we can't foresee what they are. But we appreciate you talking with us today and breaking it all down. Jeff Wise, science, tech, and adventure writer. I'm going to tweet out this story that is on Bloomberg all about Foursquare. So thanks for talking about it with us today.
Hey, my pleasure. Thanks.
All right. We're going to take a little break, get you to news. And when we come back, we are talking about a very interesting local lawsuit. Back in just a bit on 720 WGN. It's Amy Guth. You're on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today. Always grateful to you for sharing part of your Saturday afternoon with me. I'll be back here with you at 7 o'clock for the Saturday night special. We have lots to talk about tonight, but still lots to talk about today. We are joined now in studio by our friend, Chicago Tribune reporter Becky Yerach. She is here focusing always on lots of business stories happening right here in our backyard. Welcome to the program.
Thanks, Amy.
So you have written this story that I had to read it twice because I thought perhaps I had missed a detail, but it is a really unusual one. And it's all about this lawsuit against the William Wrigley Jr. Company about Starburst. You'd think these little tiny squares wouldn't hurt anybody, but nonetheless, a lawsuit has been filed.
So somebody is really up in arms over this purchase of a $2.49 bag Starburst. So this person who filed this lawsuit says on the front of the package, it says there's 130 calories per serving. But if you look at the back of the package, you know, the really boring looking box on the back, or it says 140 calories. So this person is upset, saying he would have never bought this corn syrupy sweet candy if he had known there was 140 calories per serving instead of 130. So he is suing Wrigley over this.
Okay. So I recognize that we do need consistency in our labeling. And indeed, a bag should be consistent with what it claims for nutritional information. I see his point, but it does seem, you know, a bit much, because we were talking about the difference of 10 calories. That does, you know, that raises some eyebrows. So what is, as this has been going forward, what is the sense of this? Is it, is this going to go through? Is this going to be heard by a judge? Or do you think it will probably be thrown out?
Well, he's seeking class action status. So he's betting that there are other indignant, you know, he says hundreds, if not thousands, of other indignant Starburst fans. So this is very early in this process. But there's some perhaps bad news for him. There have been two other lawsuits recently, one involving Subway footlong sandwiches and the other involving 100% grated Parmesan cheese, that both were essentially sort of thrown out. The Subway sandwich one, let's sort of take that one. That one was dismissed. These judges said, you know, basically, yes, maybe it's not exactly a foot long.
And that was the complaint, that the sandwich wasn't, in fact, 12 inches long.
Exactly. Okay. This all started because some teen in Australia, you know, had a photo of like an 11 inch. It was, you know, not 12 inches. So then there was this lawsuit filed against Subway. And essentially the judges said that, you know, the baking process, maybe it's going to shrink and it's not going to be a foot long, but the sandwich artists, I guess as they're called at
right.
Subway, can still put in as much, you know, meat or whatever on 11 inches as they can on 12 inches. So basically people are still getting the same amount of food.
Okay.
So that one didn't end well for the people suing Subway.
And so that one was class action status.
That one was, I believe, class action as well. Then there was something else involving
The Parmesan cheese
fiasco. Cheese thing. Well, let me also go back to the subway one.
Sure.
Let me clarify something there. There was a settlement there, and that was thrown out for roughly $500,000. And there were a few plaintiffs that got $500,000. That's where the judge, or I'm sorry, $500.
Okay.
And that's what the judges said. You know, common sense would have told the customers that there was some, shrinkage in
sure.
this. So that was basically what was thrown out, was this settlement
okay.
in the subway class action. And then there was the Parmesan cheese. Now, that one was dismissed. So there was a motion to dismiss it. They might amend the complaint. And more than 50 lawsuits had been filed like last year over all these retailers over 100% Parmesan cheese.
Which most of the little canisters do say.
Exactly, yeah. exactly. And there is a little bit of like, it's called cellulose. So there's something in there besides 100% Parmesan cheese. But 100% Parmesan cheese, what does that mean? Does that mean that the entire package is 100%? This is what these judges said when they dismissed this lawsuit. Or maybe it means that all the cheese is Parmesan.
Right.
Or maybe it means that 100, all of it is grated. So the judge basically said if a person was really interested, they could look to see what else was in this.
Which is kind of an interesting, to me, that seems like a little bit of a slippery slope, because as we've talked on this show often about how the label natural doesn't necessarily mean anything. So that judge, that to me, I read that like, well, it's up to us to read that nutritional box on the back, and it's less important for us to rely on whatever kind of marketing wizardry is on the front of it, which is kind of an interesting thing. But even then, I know there's been some controversy over the ingredient natural flavorings of what that can encompass can be a lot of stuff,
exactly.
which is really interesting.
Exactly.
So what are the kind of the next steps we can look for in this Starbucks case to follow it?
Starburst.
I did it. I'm looking at a Starbucks. There's one right across the street, and it came right out of my mouth. The Starburst. You're right.
I had the same fear when I was writing the story because I never really buy Starburst. Well, I think probably we're going to have like a response from the company. I did talk to the company. They said it is too early to really say, to even respond to
yeah.
this lawsuit. So we don't even know if it's going to get to the Subway. Subway made it to the appeals court. And it was an appeals court that threw out this $500,000 that was given to the lawyers. So that made it pretty far. So
yeah.
who knows? And then this other one with the Parmesan cheese, it was, thrown at, it didn't make it to the appeals court, but it was dismissed. But again, these people have apparently till September 14th to amend their lawsuit. And one lawyer that we talked to said they were going to refile it. So,
okay. Well,
yeah.
lots of interesting stuff. I mean, I can see both sides. It seems like, well, 10 calories, big deal. The other one, like, well, we do want accuracy in our labeling. I think they owe us that. So it'll be interesting to see how this one shakes out.
Yeah, the Starburst one, it was a 6-ounce package. It was a 6-serving package. So he said, I would have never bought this if I knew there was 840 calories versus 780. So I did a little bit of math. It's an 8% difference.
Okay. Well,
so,
we shall see.
I guess every calorie counts.
That's
right.
If you're really tracking it, if you're really, really tracking it down to the very last sugar and carb gram, I suppose that could wreck your day. Well, Becky Yurek, thank you so much for being with us. We will keep
turning
to you at Chicago Tribune for the latest on this and many other things.
Thank you very much.
All right. We're going to take a little break, and when we come back, we are going to be talking about an entrepreneurial story gone south. Back in just a bit on 720 WGN. Hey there, it's Amy Guth on the Wintrust Business Lunch. If you will get in the Wayback Machine, especially in internet time, because things happen so fast in the interwebs, you will recall there was an entrepreneur that was promoting this big festival, the Fyre Festival, big fancy time that was going to happen in the Caribbean. And I think some people sort of knew about it, but kind of, not really on a lot of radars unless it was not cheap to go. So unless you had the money to do so, it was not really something a lot of people were maybe paying too much attention to, other than holy moly, this is the thing that's happening. But then suddenly, all social media was suddenly flooded with some very unfortunate tweets about food and shelter needs not being met. Turns out this big festival was promoted as this big, fancy, sexy thing, and it did not quite go down that way. And so there was a lot of questions about accountability and what went wrong being aimed at the entrepreneur that created it. But he did not just create that festival. He, in fact, was working on many other things, and they all kind of started to swirl together. So it's a really interesting story, perhaps in what not to do. But here to discuss that with us, Polly Mossens, who's a business reporter at Bloomberg, joins us by phone. Hi, Polly. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
So this is just a story that is just, it's kind of unbelievable. When it first really kind of started to hit was when people were seeing tweets and Instagram and posts and videos from people at this event in the Caribbean going, wait a minute, I've just been given a piece of bologna. Hang on. This is not what I signed up for. So kind of talk us through, give us an overview of all this whole thing and the other business ventures that this guy's involved in.
Absolutely. So it all kind of came to light when everyone did see, oh my gosh, this music festival is going horribly wrong. But in reality, there had been quite a few businesses underway that were linked to the festival, particularly the Fire app, which was designed as a music booking service. So for example, if you were somebody affluent and you wanted a popular musician at your event, say a bar mitzvah or a wedding, you would go to this app and you would request them. So you'd make an offer, say, I will offer you $50,000 to perform for a half hour at my event. And the app would take a cut of that. That's how they would make their money. And they would put you in touch with the musician. The idea was to cut down the middleman, cut down the managers that are involved, so you could get straight to the musician and perhaps even pay less money. That was one of the businesses that was sort of behind the Fire Festival. The festival was actually meant to promote this app, and it did make logical sense. You know, you book a musician, you might want to go to a place that musician is performing. And well before that, there was Magnesis, kind of billed as a black card for millennials, and that was all about access, getting you into the best concerts, getting you into the best new restaurants. And that was kind of related. You know, you want access to musicians, you want access to all the best new things. The market for the two businesses were similar, but Magnesis was not actually involved in the actual Fire Festival.
Just spearheaded by the same entrepreneur.
Exactly. Spearheaded by the same entrepreneur, and their market was really similar. That's the biggest thing there. Who they were attracting would be kind of the same sort of person who might have the same amount of money.
Okay, so fast forward, we're at the Fire Festival, things start to go south very quickly, and immediately questions start to surface about accountability for this entrepreneur, Billy McFarlane.
Yes, so very quickly, people are wondering when they're going to get their money back. And after a little bit of radio silence, the company announced that they would either offer you a refund or they would offer you tickets to next year's event. At the time, it didn't seem quite as bad as it would become very soon thereafter. Very quickly, the accountability turned into civil lawsuits. Some dozen were filed, some of them requesting class action certification all across the country. There was one lawsuit filed in California seeking $100 million worth in damages for basically what people endured at the Fire Festival. On top of that, their lenders started filing, saying that they did not pay out their loans. And then on top of that, the Fed started investigating. So it ended up being class action cases, a criminal investigation, and other civil cases all together. And that's where we're at now. All of that is unraveling.
Well, that's quite an unravel. So, and this is, of course, all kind of bleeding into all of the ventures that this entrepreneur has going. And I'm sure it's not benefiting any of them. It's negatively impacting them all, I'm sure.
Exactly. So Magnesis, very shortly thereafter, they moved out of their office space. And for all intents and purposes, the company is not operational. We can't say whether they've legally closed or not. That's not for us to announce. But we can say that as far as what they do, they're not performing it. There's no way to buy a membership. There's nobody to reach out to. There's no office. So as far as we can tell, the company has ceased operations, whether it's formally closed or not. On top of that, the Fire app itself, you know, it's not really operational beyond having a website that's up, because the person who's running it is facing pretty serious charges. It would be quite difficult to operate it in these circumstances.
Right. And so what is the timeline for him now going forward, facing criminal charges, facing civil lawsuits and you know, this class action effort? What is the latest for him, and what are some key dates for us to be watching for?
So actually, just yesterday, they extended for 30 days to the end of September. That's how long he has for plea deal negotiations. Such things can always be renewed, and they tend to be. But we should be on the lookout in the next 30 days. Perhaps there might be a plea deal. If not, we should be on the lookout for the end of October. So that's one of the things we should be searching for. And on top of that, when it comes to the civil cases, they're really going to want to wait until the criminal matter is resolved. That's when the civil cases will unravel. Because if he's found guilty in the criminal case, then that really changes the matter for the civil case. It'll be a lot easier for the other defendants to go, well, look, I didn't get charged by anything with the feds. Look at the first defendant. Don't look at me. So we're really going to have to wait for the criminal matter to resolve. There's also the matter of the bankruptcy. Fire Festival LLC has to announce who their creditors are, and they really have to do that in the coming weeks. I believe that's the second week of September that we'll be on the lookout for that.
And all this is centering around this entrepreneur. We keep talking about Billy McFarland, who is a very young guy. He's in his 20s. Is he kind of key and wholly responsible here, or is this shared among some other leadership in his organization?
Well, you know, it's not for us to announce who's responsible, but I can say that the charges that were only brought against him. They were not brought against other executives in the company, not brought against other investors. The criminal charges are really focusing on him, and I think that's a reflection of who was in charge.
Sure.
Ja Rule was a partner, the prominent musician, and he was not brought up on any kind of charges whatsoever, although he is named in the civil cases. Additionally, there's other folks who are involved, you know, people that invested in the company, but they might have invested in 200 companies, and they probably don't know the day-to-day operations of each and every one. So it's really to be pointed down to the people that were handling day-to-day operations. And it looks like Billy was the primary person there.
Really, really interesting. I think this will be a case study for a very long time for a lot of business students. It really is kind of an unprecedented, strange case. But I appreciate you joining us today to break it down for us. And we will continue to look to you for the latest on this. And of course, I will tweet out the story that you have on Bloomberg that has such a wonderful explanation of all the details surrounding this case. So Polly Mossens, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you, guys. Have a good day.
Thanks, you too. All right, we are going to take a little break, get you to news, and get things turned over to the Startup Showcase with our good friend Scott Catoon here in just a bit on 720 WGN.